listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. If you read Anne Enright's newest novel, The Forgotten Waltz, you'll see why she's won so much acclaim for her fiction. As critic Edmund Gordon wrote in The Telegraph, she achieves her most brilliant effects at the level of the sentence. Her novels are mosaics of small but captivating details. She has an eye for the perfect human detail, and that is no understatement. Her new book is set in modern Dublin against the backdrop of the giddy rise and sudden fall of the Celtic Tiger economy. As Enright herself quipped in an interview, "I thought adultery was a great subject for a boom. No one could afford it in Ireland until 2001. The novel's narrator, Gina Moynihan, looks back on her early marriage, her lovely house, everything that was expected from her, from which she has furiously retreated. What truly underlies an adulterous romance? Anne Enright trains her lens on her subject without judgment, and she captures the heartbreak and the guilt, the joy and the thrill of the pursuit of desire and all its consequences with unflinching honesty, wry humor, and wonderfully nuanced prose. Anne Enright is the critically acclaimed and internationally best-selling author of essays, short stories, a nonfiction book, and four novels, including The Gathering, which won the Man Booker in 2007. She received a degree in English and philosophy at Trinity College Dublin and studied creative writing under the tutelage of the late Angela Carter at the University of East Anglia. She's also worked as a producer and director for the Irish National Television Channel, RTE, where she produced the acclaimed comedy show Nighthawks, a groundbreaking mix of satire and stand-up. Her first novel, The Wig My Father Wore, I really love this, is a novel in which a stern Irish father sports the ridiculous hairpiece of the title, which everyone pretends not to notice. Her other books include The Pleasure of Eliza Lynch, Yesterday's Weather, Making Babies, and others. And in conversation with Anne tonight, we have the wonderful playwright and poet Bridget Mullins, who is just such a gift to the Los Angeles community. She is the director of the Masters in Professional Writing program at USC. She's also directed creative writing programs at CalArts and Harvard. She's an award-winning playwright, and she received the Pinter Review Gold Medal for her play Fire Eater. Her plays have been produced in London, New York, San Francisco, and LA. And recently, she was one of seven fellows named as a 2010 United States Artist Fellow in Literature, which is a big deal. We treasure our frequent partnership with USC's writing program under Bridget's leadership, and we welcome her tonight. Please welcome Anne Enright and Bridget Mullins to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thanks, Louise. Welcome, everyone. I'm so thrilled to have Anne here. And Anne, I cannot hide my enthusiasm for this book and for your work. And we talked a little bit about the singer, Christiane McCall, who has this wonderful song, In These Shoes. And as Louise mentioned, the main character in this book, Gina Moynihan, is just a captivating woman, it's told in the first person. And so it's sort of a dramatic monologue almost throughout. And just wonderful verve and liveliness. And I wondered if we could just hear you read that chapter that's named after the Christiane McCall song, In These Shoes.
In These Shoes. Thanks, Bridget. It's been great already. It can only be downhill. After the green room, it's only downhill. Okay. This is Gina Moynihan. She has met Sean some years before. Nothing much has happened. They've had a rather exciting and yet drab one-night stand at a conference in Switzerland. And no more should be said about that, really. They aren't going to have another night stand. The affair always happens by accident, and despite their best, not their best intentions. Intention is a word that wouldn't really come into this book much. Anyway, this is just to introduce the book, I suppose, and it's a very romantic book. This is the least romantic chapter. It's the rudest of the lot. But I'm under orders from Bridget what to read. I'm always interested in what people want to hear. And this is In These Shoes. Gina is younger. Sean is what's usually called older. He's not that old. She's not that young. You know, they're both married, and she has, although she's never going to sleep with him again, clearly invited him into her company in his capacity as a management consultant. They're both in the same kind of business. Rathlin Communications puts European companies on the English language web. That's what we do. But we make it look like fun. Our office is all stripped brickwork with industrial skylights, and there is a discreet feel to the way the space is managed, an illusion of privacy, which, as anyone who works in open plan will know, just makes it worse. The paranoia, I mean. The best thing about the place is the plants contract, which is held by the boss's otherwise challenged daughter. She comes in each morning to do the foliage, which is everywhere and fabulous, from the bougainvillea going up the ironwork to the ivy cladding the bathroom walls. The Danes who did the refurbishment put in irrigation the way you might do the wiring, so the place is a thicket. And though I'm cynical about these things, the idea that a few plants makes us more green, I even voted for canaries at some meeting, only to be outvoted on the grounds of canary shit. It's the kind of place where the lift is big enough to bring your bike upstairs and all the coffee is fair trade. There's an amount of sex in the air, I suppose, but we're not that pushed. We're all pretty young. We're big on ideas. The guys who have a bed in their office are sad techie bastards who really do fold them out for a sleep. He was sitting in the meeting room that first morning. I saw him through the glass wall before he saw me, and I couldn't think what was wrong with him. He was using a fountain pen, but that was all right, wasn't it? His BlackBerry was neatly displayed on the table beside him. The suit was maybe a bit sharp, his tie a bit restrained. But, I mean, he's a consultant. He's supposed to wear a suit. Maybe it was his hair, which seemed straighter than before and flopped forward. Had he dyed it? There was at least an amount of gel involved. He looked up from under this youthful mop as I walked in and he said, "Hello, you." "Hi." He had a pair of Ray-Bans hooked onto the idle forefinger of his left hand. "You got here," I said. He let the glasses swing. "So it would appear." He seemed so sure that we would sleep together that I decided against it on the spot, or wished at least for darkness to take it away, this unexpected weakness he had for props. I sat down, smiled neatly, and said, "So, how would you like to be introduced?" The room filled and the meeting went ahead, and it was all very much as you might expect. There was the usual blather from Frank, who was being edged out to blather elsewhere. This was followed by a little posturing from my young colleagues, David and Fiacre, who were maddened by the potential gap. The boss was excited. You could tell he was excited because he seemed so bored. And I, as ever, smiled, facilitated, and kept clear because I was the girl who would win in the end, despite the fact that girls so rarely do. Sean looked from one speaker to the next, asked some questions, and kept his opinions to himself. This surprised me a little. I'd expected more of the flamboyance we saw at the conference in Montreux. But Sean at work, I have always loved Sean at work, used no more energy than was needful. It reminded me a little of his daughter Evie, this ability he had to be simple in the middle of much fuss. So I managed to forget the hair gel and the horrible architect's watch. And I just looked at him thinking for a while, his grey eyes moving from one person to the next. And it might have been a work thing, this sensible, almost offhand way we had of speaking about, let's face it, a lot of money. It might have been the fact that he was sitting in the place where I spent most of my waking hours. But it was very intimate and slightly dreamlike to see him there, like having a movie star in your kitchen drinking tea. And I really wanted to fuck him then. There was, for the first time, no other word for it. I wanted to make him real. A man I would cross the street to avoid at 9 o'clock. By 9:25, I wanted to fuck him until he wept. My legs trembled with it. My voice floated out of my mouth when I opened it to speak. The glass wall of the meeting room was huge and subtly too transparent. I felt so exposed. Not that things always go the way you might expect. 6 months later, Frank, who still does nothing but blather, was, for reasons I can't quite fathom, running much of the show. It was David who had been edged out to do his posturing elsewhere. Fiacre, meanwhile, had got himself a new baby, an ecstatic look in his eye, and a tendency to fall asleep while sitting on the toilet, much to the delight of the entire company, who tiptoed in, girls included, to listen to the sound of his snoring on the other side of the cubicle door. I was still cheerful and useful and altogether indispensable and still going nowhere in Rathlin Communications. Despite the fact I had slept with the management consultant, something neither of us found particularly relevant. I mean, no one would ever accuse Sean of securing the contract with his dick. 6 months later, I was talking to the bank about going out on my own, and the bank was licking me slowly all over, as were, now that I pause to think of it, both Sean Vallely and Connor Shields. I'm not an extraordinary woman, but this was my life that year, and yes, it felt astonishing. It also felt like a mess, the opposite of a nervous breakdown, whatever you might call that. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. The office game was another game for us to play after the suburban couples game and before the game of hotel assignations and fabulous illicit lust. And neither of us thought there might come a moment when all the games would stop. It was a lot of fun. They say consultants always recommend you lose 30%, that this is what they're actually hired to say. So when Sean was finished his report, we might be moved up or out. People found it exciting when he walked out of the lift. You knew he was there. I followed his presence through the glades of rubber plant and bamboo, listened to the click of his briefcase opening two desks down, and waited for his soft voice on the phone. He might have just put his head around my partition of fern, but his courtship was close and elaborate. Every time we spoke, it was as though we were rehearsing the lie. "Is that you?" he might say when I picked up. "Yes." I'd never had an affair before. I did not realize how sexy it was to be clandestine. The secret was everything. "Are you at your desk? What do you think?" I could hear him move and murmur a few meters away, but his real words were close, almost warm in my ear. "Busy?" "I am now. What are you doing?" "Well, I'm talking to you." The intimacy between us was so formal, so completely erotic. "I thought we might do that better over lunch." "Lovely." Mind you, there was a certain key-jangling element to it too. The idea that he might be reaching rather ardently into his pocket to check for spare change. The whole thing played surprisingly close to farce. I'm not sure how many people around us knew what was going on. At a guess, they all did and were all hugely amused by it. But we were pretty amused too. I mean, the rutting aside, the fierce and fleeting idea of it that ran across our minds, I must confess, from time to time. We also found it slightly hilarious. Thought that we might, for once, just get away with it. And this is how we overcame our doubts, because we both had major doubts. When it came to the point, some weeks later, of taking each other's clothes off, we didn't weep or declare undying love. We didn't savage each other up against some filing cabinet. We just laughed. Well, why not? We laughed when we kissed, and we laughed at every button and reluctant zip. And it was all hunger and recognition and delight. Meanwhile, I saw him at the coffee maker, and the beauty of his tie did not offend me. I even got to like his fountain pen. I was with him all the time. He knew I was there. I was getting inside his skin, the tap of his hand on the side of his thigh, the way he leaned back in the chair and rubbed his nipple for comfort or reward. He saw me noticing this and stopped. Oh, the game. The game. The little surges of irritation, of contempt from him, from me. Is this what you want? If Sean were less of a tactical person, the thing might have gone sour before we'd even begun. But he knew his pleasures. more than I did, it has to be said. He knew when to put the phone down, when to go home, when to turn away. It's no wonder I became obsessed. We had lunch every Friday for 5 weeks. It was our debrief. We went to La Stampa, fancy but not too fancy, and talked business. He was good, as I keep saying, at his job. He had no interest in complication. He'd looked at the company carefully, trying to split the rock with just one tap. And after business came charm. He told a story. He told another. Really funny stories. He ordered dessert wine. He teased me about the posh school I went to, about the height of my heels. He made me fight and flirt. I thought by week three that there was something wrong with my blood pressure, that I might actually faint or die. I took to walking home in the evening, or walking somewhere. I swerved from the entrance of the pub on a Friday because he wasn't there. I veered from the pedestrian light that was against me, crossed streets just because they were empty of traffic, and turned different corners, not so much avoiding home as averse to any particular destination. One night I ended up on the rim of Dublin Bay. It was October by then, dark and cold. There was a container ship lodged on the horizon, impossibly large and disproportionate. The endless strand gave way in the darkness to a sea so shallow you would think the thing was stuck to the ocean floor, but the lights floated in front of me. The ship was moving. Or it must have been moving. I could not tell in the darkness which way. It was also beautiful, this game of not touching. That's the thing I'm afraid to say about myself and Sean. How beautiful it was. How exquisite the distance we kept between us. And when I saw him one afternoon standing by the printer, lost in thought, with the light falling over his shoulders, it was as though the same light had jabbed me in the chest. I hadn't expected to find him there. He was wearing grey, and his hair was grey. The plants beside him were dark green, and the floor of the corridor beyond was teal blue. These are the details, and they sound so foolish. A middle-aged man in an office with a file in his hand, I mean to say. And there was no solace in his absence either. When he was gone, I thought about nothing else. Sean in my sister's garden, Sean in Britain, Sean in Switzerland. I wondered where he was this minute and what he might be doing. I thought about a future together and wiped the thought 50, 60, 100 times a day. It was all such an agitation. But somewhere in the gaps, in the certainty of seeing him after the lift doors opened, or in the shock of his voice nearby, a stillness hit, a kind of perfection. It was very beautiful, this desire that opened inside me and then opened again. And this is what puts me beyond regret, the sweetness of my want for Sean Vallely, the sense of something unutterable at the heart of it. I felt, I still feel, that if we kissed again, we might never stop.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think part of the joy of reading this book is the next line in the book after I felt, I still feel that if we kissed again, we might never stop. I lost half a stone, which was brilliant, 7 pounds. So there's that... That humor that always
Yeah, I like in. To keep a bit of flexibility in a voice, you know, so a bit of spring in there.
Yeah.
And I put in something like I lost half a stone just to annoy people who want an important book, I think.
And it's also so much about the body and their bodies and this.
Actually not their bodies so much because she always describes Sean.
Yeah.
I mean, she describes, you know, she leaves a hotel room behind and only the air knew what they had done. It's all very vague, the description of, I
of
mean,
her.
What is an almost yeah. exclusively physical relationship in the first months is never described entirely physically.
Mm-hmm.
They do a lot of kissing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But she describes his body, the whiteness of his body.
The whiteness of the body.
The way the hair is rubbed off his shins. And
oh, he's worried about that.
Yeah.
She wouldn't notice, but she sees him checking his checking his seams in the mirror, because you know age does funny things, including rubbing the hair off your calf.
And she's so likable to my mind. I mean, I find her just her ability, her spirit of full disclosure, and the way she's unmoored by him, the way she wanders around and. She's obsessed with him. And
well, she wants a disaster, and he's a great disaster to have. I mean, he's the perfect disaster. I mean, the likability or other dislikability of her has been much discussed as I've been in America, since I've come to America. And I do feel that people bring a lot of themselves to the book, not only of their life experience, but also that... Because I present, if a book is a mirror, I often present a mirror that's got cracks in it. Mm-hmm. So you pick what you want, you know. And people say, oh, she's this or that. And I think, well, no, maybe you are.
Well, you know, this, from being a theater person, this is the kind of part someone would love to play. Because this is a very complicated, interesting woman who knows she's entering something complicated.
When you say it's a dramatic monologue, you see, I like theater to do things more than monologues sometimes, most, you know.
But this triangle that she enters seems to be with the daughter. That there's the father, the daughter, Evie, who's this... You know, very interesting girl throughout, and a lot left out with Evie, it seems, as well.
Yeah, her journey is into it, not a self-knowledge. I mean, it's almost like the act of speech is when you say something and you realize as you say it what you're actually saying. So it's that kind of unreliability, that she doesn't know what she's saying because nobody does, really. It's not that she's lying. There's a slight amount of denial. But there's not really denial. There's a kind of they're getting away with it, you know. Mm-hmm. But what comes through gradually in the book is that she becomes more aware of what the reality actually is, and the reality of love. I don't know what the reality of love is. Sorry, I couldn't finish a sentence that began the reality of love is. But certainly, the reality of Sean's life, if she's going to have his life as well as his Friday afternoons. Involves his family and his daughter, Evie. Mm-hmm. And Evie is a kind of unexpected grace in the book.
And it starts with Evie, and I noticed Evie has the last word as well.
Yeah. No, Evie was... I knew all about Evie before I started. And Gina doesn't know about Evie.
Is so she where you started, Evie?
She is sort of where I started. I know a lot of kids now, since I had some myself. And I'm very interested in them. Mm. I mean, I'm very interested in the fullness of their character. Or maybe their character is not yet formed, but their personality is very strong. Their selfness is fantastically present. So I knew a lot about Evie. And Gina looks at her through the book, and she is quite averse to her. Because she knows deep down that Evie's in her way. So she describes her as being fat and stuff. It always amuses me then if a reviewer says, you know, who's fat child? You know, maybe she's not that fat. Maybe it's just, you know, or they say, you know, Sean has this very boring wife. As though it were true, as opposed to Gina saying, well, of course the wife is boring.
Yeah.
We see, she's not me.
And we see them so deeply through her eyes. It's really, I mean, going into the book is really going into this person, into her, the taboo. She tells us, I'd never had an affair before. I did not realize how sexy it was, you know. And this idea of the affair itself, that she's entering into this thing.
But the affair keeps breaking down. I mean, on their Friday afternoons, she said they didn't speak much. She said silence made it that bit filthier, of course, which is a bonus, a plus, right? But then they can't help but talk because they quite like each other. They're both quite very chatty, both very social people. And so they'd have these long conversations that they weren't really supposed to have. And they know they're not really supposed to be having these long conversations because they're supposed to be having an affair.
Yeah.
So he buys her perfume because that's what he's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. because she's his mistress.
Because, yeah, she turns into the mistress for about 2 minutes. It doesn't really suit her.
And there's this tradition of the adulteress in literature.
Yes.
And when I was growing up, the first adulteress I met was Hester Prynne, mm-hmm. who became an outcast. And then there was Anna Karenina, who committed suicide. And then there was the other one, Madame Bovary, who also committed
suicide. Died so horribly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So things have changed a bit recently for the adulteresses, but
yeah.
Gina sticks with it. She sticks with the...
She does, and she lives... she does. I'm thinking of an adulterer who is mm-hmm. in Fort Madox Ford's The Good Soldier, is Edward, who is the good soldier of the title, who at the who is a very wonderfully complex adulterer, but he falls in love with his ward, with the girl that he and his wife are rearing. He's so appalled by the fact that he's now about his sexual incontinence, or the incontinence of his desire, basically, that his wife opens the bedroom door and finds him on his knees praying by the bed, presumably for... And then it all ends horribly, of course. But I loved the figure of the girl.
Mm-hmm.
And the girl is described very glancingly by Fort Madox Ford, but she's fully there. I mean, she's 18 or 19. She wears white. And she's fully there as a person. She gets up at a shriek in one of his sentences. And I just thought that, yes, falling in love with a girl is a beautiful thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And a spiritual thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought it was interesting to have Gina fall in love with the girl.
Mm-hmm. And she pays attention to her in such an interesting way. She seems to, you know, her descriptions of her. There's this one, the part where she sees all the girls at her niece's party and her niece is friends with Evie. So there's this kind of proximity that she has to her.
Yeah, she has two. She has a niece, Megan, who's about the same age as, who tracks ages with Evie. And, I mean, Gina's such a wretch. You know, she says Megan is so healthy and large and Megan is a fantastic, messy little item. And there's no doubt about her nieces and nephews being the best thing in the, you know, in Enniskerry, County Wicklow, whereas Evie is endlessly problematic. I know we were talking earlier that you wanted maybe a little passage.
Yes, this one, it's the one where they're coming over to the party, and you're describing this juncture that happens in young girls, and I'm just so struck by the way you describe the relationships between girls and how their bodies change.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of anxiety about puberty in this book, which is not particularly one I share, but I do see it around me, particularly female puberty, and it's younger and they're younger and they're younger, and the sexual, not the sexual availability, which is also terrible to us, of but the nascent desires of young girls. It clearly discomforts us a lot, I think, because nobody gets all that fussed about boys, even though boys are the ones who end up in trouble. You know, they crash the car, the girls are usually okay. I mean, and everybody freaks out about miniskirts. Okay. And they grow up and they're lovely. But anyway, this is a birthday party, and she's just had the one night stand in Montreux.
Mm-hmm.
So what a peculiar thing then to see the man's daughter. What a peculiar thing. It's always interesting to meet people's children, whether or not you had a one-night stand with them in Montreux. Anyway, she says, I had a mild interest in Evie that day, seeing as I'd slept with her father, don't you know? But I couldn't figure out which one she was. Now, she's seen her at the age of a few years previously. The girls Megan had invited were ridiculously large and hard to fathom. They wore oversized party dresses or funky tops. Two, at least, were in tracksuit bottoms. You couldn't even tell who they thought they were. These people had, besides, no interest in us. They had each other to love. The way they looked at each other was so passionate and shy. I set out the plates with the real linen napkins that Fiona handed me and the real glasses and metal cutlery. I put a jug of sparkling water on the table and another of orange juice, all of which I thought silly. These were big, uncomfortable children, not grown-ups. Throw a bag of tortilla chips at them, I thought, and retire. Who wants lasagna? One girl, a tall, soft creature called Saoirse, raised her hand. She was stuffed into a pink satin dress that a five-year-old might choose, and under her arm was a haze of golden red hair. I glanced at Fiona. She rolled her eyes in dread. These children weren't growing so much as being replaced. Come and eat. It troubled me quite a bit, actually, the hair. It looked beautiful when it should have been disgusting. And it was twice as disgusting as it should have been when you looked up from it to the big pudding face of the child. I should get out more, I thought. This cannot be as strange as I think it is. And I also thought, something has gone wrong. Then I saw Evie. She revealed herself with a flash of her father's two beautiful eyes. It happened when she looked straight at me, like the opening of a hidden door. She was still a bit puppyish around the chest, but the fat was mostly gone. And something else had changed. I mean, apart from everything, because everything had changed. But something essential had shifted. She looked happy. Or not happy so much as connected for once, not so scared. It made me uneasy, the idea that she used to be afraid. I wondered what kind of man I had slept with. How many months ago now? And would he arrive in through the door? 3 months. It was 3 months since Montreux, and I never wanted to lay eyes on Sean Vallely again. I wasn't just mortified. I was actually averse. The thought of speaking to him was slightly soiling, like putting on used clothes after you've had a shower. Is that as much as you wanted?
That's great.
Sorry.
But then there's that next paragraph, actually.
She's very sensitized, Gina. I mean, yeah.
But she says, I watched her as though she might hold some key to this man.
Yeah, I'll just do that little thing. Yeah. Even so, I was caught by his daughter. I watched her as though she might hold some key to this man, whose eyes seemed to make more sense on her face than they did on his own. The long black lashes, just the same sea grey with a pale sunburst around the pupil of white or gold. I had nothing to say to her. Would you like some juice?
And then later on, Evie actually knows her name, and that's a surprise. And we hear that
you're very smart.
But
actually, that's the first time we hear her name in the book. Is that Evie notices? It says her name. Mm-hmm. It's the first time her name is mentioned in the book. It's said by Evie. Children's attention is so wonderful. I mean, it's such a blessing. You can't make a child hold your hand.
It's so surprising.
A child reaches up and holds your hand. You go, okay.
She talks about Montreux there, and that's another description of the adultery. That's just after their first night together, when she wakes up in the hotel, and this all kind of comes together. There's so much going on in the novel in terms of where it is, the places that they move around Europe, the economic crash that happens during the trajectory of the novel, what you're doing with time. It's a miracle. How did you write this book? But okay, let's just go back to something else here. This night after their night together at the hotel in Montreal.
Yeah, she lurches around the hotel corridor. She can't find her room, and she tries to get into the wrong door and everything. So
yeah.
That's all very sad.
Can we look at that? Can we read that?
No, I'm not going to do that.
No?
It's too sad.
It is, but it's also very funny.
No, anyway, this is the next morning. So some shutter came down when she gets into her own room, and it did not rise until I woke the next day, safe in my own bed, half undressed, with all the lights ablaze. It maddened me. I did not feel guilty exactly, but I did feel a little mad, I think. I couldn't face the breakfast room for a start. I put my sunglasses on and headed to a local patisserie. Then I took my hangover to the railway station, and I got the first train out of there, a neat old-fashioned little thing with bench seats, which went a surprising distance up into the mountains through tunnels and hidden passes until it emerged into high meadowlands strewn with alpine flowers and grazed by chocolate bar cows with bells around their beautiful pendulous mauve necks. The few scattered houses had heart shapes cut out of their wooden balconies and white quilts thrown over the rails to air in the sun. And it was all so wonderful and silly, I decided to get out at Gstaad, which turned out to be a village of a few streets with twee little shops, all with names like Rolex or Cartier. There was a Gucci shop and a Benetton shop and a delicatessen full of astonishing cheese. I walked the entire village and there wasn't a single place where you could buy cornflakes or muesli or even toilet paper. And I wondered, did the rich people get these things flown in? Perhaps they did not need them. They had moved beyond. My adultery, I didn't know what else to call it, lingered in my bones. A slight ache as I walked, the occasional disturbing trace of must. I had showered that morning. Do I have to read this?
Oh, it's so good.
I had shower that morning, but I realised I'd have to go back and clean up again. And the thought made me laugh out loud. It was a vaguely horrified laugh, but still. I did not feel guilty that afternoon in Gstaad. I felt suicidal, or the flip side of suicidal. I felt like I had killed my life and no one was dead. On the contrary, we were all twice as alive. I also felt as I went to pack and faced the dreaded Sean that the whole business was a little disappointing, let's face it, as seismic moral shifts go. In the foyer and on the minibus to the airport, he ignored me so strenuously I felt like writing him a note. What makes you think I might care? It was hardly worth mentioning, not to Sean and certainly not to Connor. And though this seems hard to believe, I returned to my Dublin life as though nothing had happened, as though the lake, the mountains, the whole of Switzerland was a lie someone had told to keep the rest of the world amused. Which is also possible that Switzerland is a lie, we were told. They go to Switzerland because it's beyond the EU. They're trying to move. The Irish had the EU connection, so they're trying to move to Poland, China, you know, beyond the EU. So that's why the conference is set in Switzerland. Set in a kind of, it's not set in the hotel where Nabokov lived, but it's similar, a bit more run down the shores of Lake Geneva.
And she's competent.
And Switzerland is important as a kind of center of money and banking and stuff like that the book. Yeah,
and they're quite successful, and as things are going along in Ireland at the beginning.
Yes, everyone was successful in Ireland. There was no such thing as failure in Ireland. Everybody was successful.
And then it crashed.
I mean, not necessarily people I knew.
Yeah. So she goes...
The place is awash with money, it seemed, you know.
And she goes from working in IT to working...
In the drinks industry.
In the drinks industry.
Because she's a smart chick. She realizes that, you know, that in a downturn, people still drink.
And you call it Alcohol. And you do this thing throughout, which I noticed, where you always capitalize brand names, okay.
Yeah.
But then you capitalize certain words as if they were stage directions.
Okay.
One thing that you capitalize a couple of times is you have no idea, and three different characters say that. You have no idea, you have no idea.
Oh, you have no idea. Yeah. her sister has a mobile home, which is just like a trailer, but it's on the sea, and they cost about 100 grand in Ireland, in this particular beach, and all the solicitors would be down there, the solicitor children. And Fiona says the woman up three doors up has wooden blinds, and she says it was only a caravan. Sort of, essentially, Gina says. And Fiona says, you have no idea. But that was the incredible learning curve. I mean, I don't really laugh about people for being poor or for being rich or for that horrible aspirational thing in the middle. it doesn't, you know, because people, when they get money, they learn really fast, you know. So they're all posh in a minute, you know. But they're all in the book. They're all going through that curve. So Fiona has terracotta floors, and then she has to rip them up because it has to be limestone in our kitchen. And she's right; it has to be limestone. You know, and it's much nicer.
And the book is so funny, but there's so much loss in it. You know, there's that they lose the houses, some of it, they lose the jobs.
Yeah, I mean, the turning point of the book really is when the mother dies, yeah. And they've all been, and the mother is sort of, I mean, a much romanticized children by both her daughters, I think, a very beautiful and dashing sort of woman. And she dies. And that is when the affair sort of, which had ended, starts to trickle on again. Some sweet underground spring kind of continues mm-hmm. on. And that's mm-hmm. that. But she has to sell the house. They have to sell the house. Mm-hmm. And the mother dies in spring 2006. And that was when nobody realized that it was all over. And it took Ireland 3 years to realize it was all over. So those houses were on the market, the unsellable for year, mm-hmm. 2 years at least. And as I wrote the book, I started in February 2009, and I thought, what will happen if the houses all start selling before I finish this book? Because that'd be interesting, not that it would spoil the book, but or it would still damage the reception of the book, but it would be interesting to know from my writing of the book. But it really didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so there was this stasis and this sense of drop. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. And holding the line, but we weren't sure, over the canyon, basically. That went on for an enormously long time. And by November 2010, I think, if I have the dates right, I was finishing the book and the International Monetary Fund walked in the door and he said, now we know. We at least see the bottom of the canyon. Now we know what this is about. Mm-hmm. We can't pay our school teachers. So the fact that the 2 million euro house, which was unsellable, that's just the chandelier, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, that's just the thing hanging up there, you know?
Yeah.
It does make me quite cross. I mean, although the book isn't in any strict sense allegorical, which, because that would be to close it off somehow. But it did seem that a boom and a adulterous affair were a good mix, mm-hmm. you know.
And can we talk for a second about the time element before, and we'll open this up for questions in a moment, but the time element and how you orchestrated it. I was telling you before, oops, hi, about...
You're like Madonna. like Madonna.
I really was thinking a lot about Beckett's play when I was reading this, which is three adulterers in limbo in urns.
Yeah.
And they're each speaking their experience past each other. And the way he wrote it, apparently, is that he wrote each one and then he wove them together. But there's that sense of time, and then the last stage direction in the play is repeat play. Mm-hmm. So it has that circular, you're in this limbo of these adulterers. And one of the lines is, adulterers take note, never confess. You know, and she doesn't confess. She's found out. They're found out. But there is this feeling like she's trying to figure out the order to tell things in. And I'm just curious, did you write it chronologically? How did you write such a thing? It just seems like so fully realized as a world.
Well, to give a rather abstruse answer, it would be to say that there are two senses of time in the book. One is the kind of spreading eternal nowness of love, which is beyond connection, beyond cause and effect, which is not quite transcendental, but which is, yes, given, which is doesn't, because there's no why to it or there's no how. How did I end up loving this man? There's no, these are difficult things to parse. And then there is the this happened and then that happened and then that happened. So the two Those are the two axes of the book.
Mm-hmm.
The now that you know, or you know, pick an axis, right? And so, but I wrote it. I decided to give myself a break on this book, and I looked out the window on February 2006, and I said, "This is the day on which the book is set." So I planted my feet very firmly on the floor on that day, and I said, "This is the absolute now of the book. Mm-hmm. This is the day it is typed out, right, as it were. This is the day she's thinking about. Mm-hmm. This is the day she goes to meet Gina." So that gave me some structure, which it's always nice to have. So I could go back to 2002 and I always knew where I was in the timeline and I knew what that moment meant. But as a personal discipline, I wrote it, unusually for me, pretty much one chapter after the other in order.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not how I usually write. And I thought in a book that questions cause and effect so much, it would be very useful to do it. This happened and then that happened and then that happened. And then to ask, did this cause that? Was it? Anyway, these are, I don't know if these are useful things to know. But I wrote it as you read it.
And
which I've never done before. And so I knew everything.
Huh. How did you know everything?
I knew everything. I didn't know. I mean, there's... The pleasure is finding out mm-hmm. how that you know most of it, or you know the bones of it, and then the.
So when you say she went to meet Gina, you're saying when Evie went goes.
When,
to
oh
meet
no, sorry, when Gina goes to meet Evie,
okay,
which she does
at the end on
February 2006,
which is just so delicious, and we don't have time to read it, but it's so delicious as is. I mean, it's you sort of know what will happen from the preface.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fantastic. So you're reading it to find out how it happens.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, as I always destroy books, but this one is extra destroyed. I mean, this is like, you just can't read this book without stopping and underlining and thinking, who the hell is this woman? She's fantastic. I'm talking about Gina, not you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's just, I fell in love with this character. She's just so funny. She's so smart. And she's brave in this way.
She's an adulteress, a liar, a homewrecker, a man-stealer.
Ah, not in my book.
She'd rather spend her money on handbags than on childcare.
Hmm. Hmm.
So that's what you think of her, too?
Yeah.
Well, I actually wanted those books to exist all at the same time. A book about a woman in love, a book about a homewrecker, man-stealer, whatever she is, you know. So I wanted those to exist side by side. I mean, absolutely, you know, so that the book would be morally poised and that you'd be sort of wrong-footed by it,
mm-hmm.
which is why I put a line like, I lost half a stone after mm-hmm. after that paragraph about how exquisite the distance was, the not touching.
Mm-hmm.
So I want them to be braided, as it were, throughout
mm-hmm.
the book.
Mm-hmm.
Those three things.
Yeah, you do feel a tenderness for her.
For Gina.
I did.
I do.
Yeah.
Well, I'd want to, wouldn't I? But
no.
No, I do. But some people have been very judgmental, which interests me as well.
It's
very strong,
it's
Puritan reactions.
Yeah, it's very interesting. She's just so delicious. So we have, I guess we have, if my watch is right, we have about 10 minutes. So now is the time to open it up to questions. So if you've had questions brewing, we have a mic going around.
I'm going to try to say this. I'm going to try to say this and get out what I'm really asking you. So I stumble a bit. The subject of adultery is so familiar to us in literature and in life, and our friends and magazines. So I wonder what brought you to it, because it's almost a cliche to talk about adultery or try to write about it. So I'm thinking, you know, what allowed you? Could you speak to what it was? Was it the characters? Was it the particular character that you found, that you loved, that came into your head in her life? Or was it the topic, the subject, the overview of that experience?
Yeah, I've written about adultery from before, when I was really quite young, as a writer. when it shouldn't have really been of interest to me. And I don't quite know, well, I mean, I don't quite know the answer to that question. I mean, the deep answer to the question is that very few people have written successfully about monogamy. Monogamy is an incredibly difficult subject, and it is a condition that, you know, 50% of relationships are monogamous, if you read the same magazines I do with their statistics. So it is hugely impossible. I remember somebody writing about it very deliberately and setting out to write about it, and the next thing he'd switched partners. And it is, I mean, that would be a book. Right, that would be a book. So I did look at boom time literature, because when The Gathering came out in Ireland, everyone was saying this is the wrong book because it's too miserable, and we've gotten over all that now, we have money, and why is nobody writing about the boom, and why are we dragging all this horrible, miserable stuff up, right? So I decided that I would look at, I mean, I was thinking about what is a literary response to a boom. And there are various ones. But I looked at post-war American literature with Richard Yates. These are just when societies are beginning to get money, beginning to break up, you know. Richard Yates and then Cheever and then later Updike, where, you know. And a little then at the Hampstead novel in London, and that 60s boom. I'm just saying, these were not full boom, jazzy, new journalism sort of books. Do you know what I mean? These were relationship books. So I thought it was a very good topic for a society that's in shift. And, as I'm tired saying, much more fun to write about than cups of tea.
I like to ask people how they sort of get the genesis to do or beginning of what they do. All of a sudden, you're not just walking down the street and you say, I'm going to be a writer. But what was it that nurtured you on as a young person or a child to do what you're doing today? I can tell you with my own self, but I'd like to know about you.
Yeah, well, cause and effect are the novelist's great subject. I don't know whether I would have ended up here by another path. There were books in the house. I live in a country where a writer is someone, you know. But there are so many. My general line on it is that it's an arranged marriage, that I didn't decide to be a writer. It was decided for me by family and teachers and various people who thought that someone like me would be, that's what you did. I'm not sure, though. I really needed to write. And in my darker hours, in my 20s, were difficult enough years, and I thought I didn't exist unless I wrote. So, I mean, it's very... Well, I got it. My family gave me a typewriter for my 21st birthday, so it was a bit of a hint, you know. I'd written one story by hand, but the big clicky-clacky typewriter was fantastic. An electric typewriter. And so, yeah, and my sister's a doctor. We gave her stethoscopes and ear things and everything, you know. So we were given the tools of our trade on our 21st birthday. So it was a hint. And I am the last of, the youngest of five siblings. And I think that once my mother in particular had her children safely guided into various professions, she had the luxury of a writer at the end. Be careful what you want.
I'm kind of glad nobody handed me a scalpel when I was 21. That would have killed a lot of people. I wonder if you have any observations about the state of American fiction, contemporary fiction, in comparison with European contemporary fiction, and the writer's place in our society to the extent that you know about it and in Europe.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody today who was asking me about particularly the importance of male American writers. I think I'm expected to say something about gender in America, and I don't know what. And of course, I said something that will be endlessly flung back at me. But no, I'm not saying that to you. I'm just saying a reader I was talking to last week, said, I never read American fiction. I read Irish fiction, English fiction, and Scottish fiction. And I said, but American fiction is wonderful. I read American fiction a lot. And it's something, you know, we often talk about writers needing some elsewhere, you know, Joyce going into exile or whatever. But I wonder whether the reader also doesn't like elsewhere and that other countries' fiction is always more foreign. Yeah, but also that, you know, if you have views on America, then you will want to see them reflected or not in the fiction. You know, that I also, I'm not answering this very well, but I spoke to a friend who, unlike me, did not admire Alice Munro to the, you know, and he was Canadian. And as I spoke to him, I realized that he thought Alice Munro was writing about what it was to be a woman in Ontario in the 1980s. And I didn't give a damn about what it was to be a woman in Ontario in the 1980s. I didn't, that about, or as the Canadians would say, about, doesn't occur to me. So Irish people read Irish writers as though we're writing about them. But actually, a writer writes from a culture. Mm-hmm. So you write from Ireland rather than, you know, about Ireland. I think American fiction is about, I was reading Marilyn Robinson, her book Gilead on the plane, and I just thought, wow.
And Alice Munro does such interesting things with time too.
Yeah, she's a big swooper over time. Yeah. She's got a great swoop. At the she's fabulous. Memory, which is
just amazing. Do we have any more time, Louise? One or two.
When you said you were compelled to write, that you had to write as a youngster, what were you writing, stories, or were you journaling, or was it autobiographical stuff?
I wrote very bad poetry in school. Sorry, I'm just going through my files there. I did journal. The typewriter was a bit of a liberation because I don't write longhand because my sentences are too personal and too pleased with themselves and they go on and on and on. And I couldn't rewrite them then because they're somehow true or part, physically sort of part of me. And so the typewriter was a good little separation. I wrote a short story that was a fragment and very strange short story, which subsequently was published in my first publication. And I wrote it, I sat down and wrote it. That was by long had before I got the typewriter. And then I spent perhaps 10 years trying to write a proper short story. And failing miserably, like a third person past tense, this happened and then this happened. Now, it took me maybe 10 years to realize I didn't have to write properly. You know, I didn't have to be a kind of, I could use fragments, I could use voice. I didn't have to tie things up.
One more?
A moment ago you spoke about knowing everything before you got started, but you also made reference to sort of discovering, and I've heard other writers when they talk about their writing, sort of discovering the characters as you write about them, almost as if you're in relationship with them and it's happening in real time. I was curious if you ever get stuck or you found yourself backed into a corner with a description.
We don't have the word stuck in our house.
No?
No, we leave it outside the door. We use rude words all the time, but stuck isn't allowed. I have something to go to. This book wasn't going to get stuck. I knew that it just wasn't. I mean, The Gathering was nothing but stuck. I mean, it was written despite the fact that I couldn't write it. But I could write this one. And The Gathering, I was stuck for 4 years, you know, and then there's a book. If you say I'm stuck, then you are stuck. It's like inviting the vampire in. If you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you're just working. You're just working.
That's probably an excellent place to say thank you so much, Anne. great.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.